we've noted many times that this year is a model of history, besides being a model of the natural year, but not history as well. The year flows essentially this Nisan to Adar, Pesach to Purim. Pesach, which are from Mitzrayim, is founded by Israel. Then flows to Purim, which is another flow. So we have to understand how the two kind of fit together. Last week we discussed the idea of Ashkacha, Purim Pesach, Gilui Panim, and Esther Panim, Hashem being revealed. But there's another Indian here as well. There's a different Indian of showing how history flows. And the way I like to see it is that we're kind of moving our roots onto our destiny. From Bnei Yisrael being talented and being created, to Bnei Yisrael experiencing the future, experiencing our final tachlis, our final kula, in the entire world. The Adar is the final month of the year. So as the final month of the year, Adar is supposed to present to us a miniature experience of our future, of a perfect world that we're trying to head towards, or yearning towards. The vision of Yemos HaMashiach, I'll talk about more why that is, but I think Purim itself is a day you're supposed to taste Mashiach, supposed to feel Mashiach, taste Mashiach, because Purim is essentially, again, the last month of the year means we hit a goal, we hit our purpose, we hit our end, our destiny, we cross the finish line. Nisan comes again afterwards, we start over again. Every year there's a new cycle. So Nisan comes, and again we experience a rebirth. We'll talk about that in Pesach. So Pesach is a time of rebirth and of starting again, fresh. But Purim is the end of the year, which means it's going to be our final destination, our final tachlis, and really a taste of what it's like to experience the world in its perfect form. Nisan is where we were created as a people, and Adar is our destiny. That's really how I put it all together. In a certain way, this is kind of a side point, but in a certain way, the fact that we have Pesach, that itself leads to Purim. What do I mean by that? Because Hashem makes Klal Yisrael. Hashem makes the people. We have to be able to reach our purpose. Hashem doesn't make mistakes. Hashem doesn't create things that aren't going to fulfill their tachlis in this world. What Hashem makes will hit its destiny, will hit its purpose, it will hit its goal, for sure. So Pesach is when we were created. Pesach was the Yantif that created Klal Yisrael. That's what Pesach is. So Pesach, by definition, will lead to a final redemption. It can't be that we're left in this world in concealment, in gullus, in difficult times forever. The world has to reach a goal because Hashem made the world. If Klal Yisrael has a purpose, we will reach his purpose. So Pesach really leads to Purim. Purim, as we'll see, is considered a day where we celebrate our final purpose, celebrate our tachlis, celebrate hitting the goal, crossing the finish line. And Pesach guarantees that. Which in my mind is one reason why we don't realize this, but most of the Purim story happened on Pesach. If we look at the Megillah carefully, the first parak occurs in the third year of Achashverosh's reign, the second parak is in the fifth year of his reign, and then Haman only comes on the scene 7 years later in the 12th year of his reign. Haman's decree to kill the Jews, he made his goral, he drew his lottery, and he made his decree in Nisan, right before Pesach. 3 days of fasting overlapped with Yontif, and they skipped the Seder that year. And Haman was killed on Pesach. Haman was killed the second day of Pesach. Many, many Jews have a minhag to make a Sudas Haman on Pesach and celebrate Haman's death. Haman's Yortzeit on Pesach, so you make a Yontif to celebrate Haman's death. So people have a minhag to actually make a special Suda to mark Haman's death on Pesach. So there's a big connection between Pesach and Purim. There's actually an interesting remez, you can say. It says in Sefer Yehoshua that the man stopped falling on the second day of Pesach. And the pasuk says, Vayishbos Haman Imachros HaPesach. So literally means the man stopped. But you can look at it also, Vayishbos Haman. Haman stopped on the second day of Pesach. So Haman died day two of Pesach, as you can remember it. And Pesach and Purim are connected. Because Pesach makes Purim inevitable. If there's going to be a Pesach, we cannot be totally destroyed. Because Pesach means that Klal Yisrael is created, we're Hashem's nation, we have a purpose, and no Haman is able to totally annihilate us. It's possible, we will come through, we will succeed, and we will certainly hit our goal one way or the other. That's what Pesach tells us, that's what Purim tells us. So Adar and Purim is really the month of destiny. It's the month where we're supposed to celebrate who we are, where we're going, and taste what it means to hit that goal, cross the finish line. So I want to discuss with you an idea which I feel personally really speaks to me as an essential idea of Purim. Really, when I learned about this idea years ago, and since then my Purim has been changing a bit. It's such an important idea. It really hits so many points about Purim, and it really flips the day around to a much more meaningful day. Many of us, I'm not sure if those of us in this room have the problem, but many of us feel that Purim is really like a children's event. You know, in shul, like, it's a big emphasis on the costumes, and the kids have lots of candy and partying. But Purim is considered one of the holiest days of the year, if not the holiest day of the year. The Arizal famously compares Purim to Yom Kippur. Yom Kippurim is the word Purim, because Yom Kippur is merely like Purim. Purim is the paradigm. Purim is the top. Purim is the holiest day of the year. Kabbalistically, on Purim, the most oros, the most lights from Hashem enter our world on Purim, more so the rest of the year. It's considered Kabbalistically the top, the holiest day, the day of the most potential, the highest day of the year. And for us, we lose it a lot of time in the excitement, not focusing on what the day, the meaning of the day is. We lose it in terms of being a kiddie holiday. We lose it in a lot of different ways. But we have to understand how deep and how profound Purim really is and what the day can mean for us. So we're going to understand more, a much deeper idea about Purim. So let's just start with a few different questions about Purim, as points I'll point out about the Megillah and about the Lachs of Purim, and we'll see how Purim really represents to us a day that we're supposed to taste what's like at Mashiach in the world. The first question is the following. The actual day that Haman is slated for our destruction was Yud Gimel Adar, the 13th of Adar. That was the day, as the Megillah says, Yom Asher Sibru Oyvei Yehudim Usolpahem and Hafakru. That's the day that our enemies had destined to destroy us on. And the Hafakru, and it was turned around, it was reversed, and instead of our enemies killing us, we destroyed our enemies. That was the 13th of Adar. But the Yom Tov we make is on the 14th. So the miracle occurred on the 13th of Adar, but yet we celebrate the next day. It's a very funny thing. On Pesach, we celebrate the day we left Mitzrayim. We don't celebrate the next day. The 7th day of Pesach is the day of Kriyas Yom Suf. We don't celebrate the next day because that's not the miracle. Shavuos is the day of Matan Torah. We don't celebrate the next day. Chanukah is the day where we're able to enter into the Beis HaMikdash and reclaim it for Klai Yisrael. We don't celebrate the following day. We celebrate the day. But Purim is the next day. It's a very funny thing. Why is Purim on the next day? And that's what Esther requests. I mean, Esther talks about, all of the Megillah talks about, that it was the day that we were Noah, the day we rested. If you look at the sheet I passed out, look at source two. Source two says, "L'kayim aleihem we'os usim es yom arba'asar l'chodesh Adar." It says that they wanted us to establish upon ourselves the 14th of Adar, v'es yom chamisha sarbo, the 15th of Adar, the chol shana v'shana, every single year, k'yom asher nachu b'mihudim, the days that we rested on Yehudim from our enemies. So we're not celebrating the victory, we're celebrating the rest after the victory. That's what it says in the Megillah. Then it says, the Chodesh, the month, I mean, it's not just the day, the whole month of Adar is enough celebration. As we know, Marvin B'Simcha, for those who saw the yeshiva this morning, it was decorated for the month of Adar by the high school. V'choshir nepach l'miyogun l'simcha v'evil yom tov. It's the month that was flipped from anguish to simcha, from mourning to yom tov. To make it a days of Mishteh v'simcha, Meshloch Manis v'tas levyonim. But the stress here is that it's the days of Sher Nachu, the days we rested upon. And the Megillah a few times stresses that we were Noach Mevehem, we rested from our enemies in those days. So we have to understand, why is it we celebrate the day that we rested, not the day that we actually fought and succeeded? That's not the typical model of Yom Tov. The concept of the next day, of the Machar, as you saw this year, I wrote on top, Purim Machar, appears a few other times in the Megillah. We find that Esther holds two priorities for Ahasuerus and Haman. So she comes in, she risks her life to go into the king. He says, "What would you like, my dear Esther?" He says, "Come to a party with me, bring Haman with you." So they come to the party, he says, "Mabakashase, what would you like?" She says, "Come back again tomorrow." That's what she says. Very, very funny. You read the Megillah, Mefarshim struggle with why did she wait until the next day. The Gemara talks about it too, but it's funny. She had him at the party, and she said, he said, "What's your request?" She said, "Come back again tomorrow for another party." So it's the Machar, it's the next day again. And then you find as well, when they're actually fighting against their enemies, so Achashverosh comes to Esther and says, "Okay, you know, you're the Jews have killed out their enemies. What else would you like?" And she requests, "Please give me Machar, the next day, so the Jews in Shushan can fight some more." She requested Machar, the next day. And again, like, why is all this stress on the next day? It's a very funny thing to stress. We celebrate the next day, Esther has a party on the next day. She wants to fight more on the next day. There's always this emphasis on machar when it comes to Purim. It's a very funny thing. So I don't understand this idea on a deeper level. And it's really a profound concept of Purim, which we can understand. The ideas I'm sharing are based on really the Maharal and the Pachad Yitzchak. Those are the two major svarim that I think bring out these ideas. But they really fit a lot about Purim. So if you think about the world, history of Klai Yisrael, history of the world, you can break it down really into three separate phases. Let's break it down. The first phase was very short-lived. That was Gan Eden. Adam and Chava Gan Eden. The second phase was after the Chet, until this very day, meaning the normal existence we live in day-to-day life. And the third phase, Yimus HaMashiach. Mashiach comes, the world hits its final tikkun, the world is perfected and actually fulfills Hashem's purpose in creation. Those were our three different periods of the world. So let's understand these three different eras, three different periods, and see how they play out in understanding what the world was like during those times. The first period, again, the short-lived period in Gan Eden, was a very different existence. It was an existence in the world where it was total clarity. We understood Hashem, we understood the world, we understood our purpose in life. Adam and Chava lived in a different existence. The Zahara was not inside them, it was external to them. That's why they had to have the snake come and persuade them to do an Avera. It wasn't within. For us, when we want to do an Avera, we tell ourselves, I want to do that. No, I don't. No, I do. No, I don't. And we struggle inside. In Gan Eden, no, the person himself or herself was inside very pure, and the enticement came from without. But inside, there's no Yitzhara, there's no death, they're supposed to live forever. It was a world where Hashem was clear. It was a world where they saw the goodness of Hashem and everything they did. Itzadat Tovara was their challenge, and Tovara means that once you eat from this tree, you're going to now see Ra. Your life used to be totally Tov. All you could see was the truth of Hashem. And after they eat from the tree, and again, this is its own discussion, but a short way of explaining it, at that point, enter into the person the ability to confuse good and evil, to see things in the world that you think are bad and are good, or vice versa, and everything became very, very muddled, very confused, very unclear for them. So Hashem became hidden, they couldn't perceive Hashem in the same way. A person could feel, we spoke of this a while back, they could hide from Hashem and do things against Hashem's will, and just everything in life became much more confusing. That's happened after they've made Tzedas Tovara. What caused this transition to happen? Because then we're in that world now. We're in the world post the Chet. The eighth day Tzedas Tovara, and ever since then we're in a different world. There are ups and downs. You know, sometimes the world is more clear, less clear. There's Hashkacha which is open, Hashkacha which is hidden. But ultimately the world is not a clear place to live in. Things are confusing in life. And where does that come from? So it came from the Nachash, convincing Chava to eat from the tree. That's where it came from. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin. Did I put that on the sheet? Yeah, if you turn on the sheet to source number 10 on the sheet. These sources aren't in any order. This kind of all put onto the sheet. But that's why they're numbered. If you go to source number 10, the Gemara says, Hama mir Torah minayim. The Gemara wants to know, where do you find a reference to Hama in the Torah? Now, the truth is, it's a funny question, because Haman lived well after the Torah. Haman lived in Shushan, in between the first and second Beis Hamikdash. So we're talking now about the year approximately, let's say, 400 BCE or so. We're talking about a good 2,000 years after the Torah. Purim is their abundant holiday. It's not their rice, it's their abundant. So Haman's in Megillas Esther. But the Gemara wants to know, where do you find a reference to Haman in the Torah? And that kind of question means, we're not looking for the person, the individual named Haman. We're looking for where does he find the source for his type of evil, the source for his type of rishus, the source for his own what he does in the world. Where do you find that in the Torah? Where's an example of Haman in the Torah? And the answer is Hamin Ha'etz. So the word Hamin is the same letter as Haman, and that's the question that Hashem asked Adam. Hamin Ha'etz, did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? So the Gemara finds a reference to Haman in the Torah from Hashem accusing Adam for eating from the Eitz HaDaas. So that connection is now made. We see that whatever happened in Gan Eden, the idea of eating from the Eitz HaDaas, Haman is associated with it. Chazal tell us, Hamin Ha'etz is a reference to Haman. Haman is a reference to Haman. So if we want to take it back for a second to understand what we're talking about here, Haman in some way is an offshoot of the original sin. of the Nachash. And really where this comes from is a much different source. Because Haman we know hails from Amalek. As we read about Parsha Zachar next week, Amalek is the nation which, you know, we have mitzvah to destroy. And Haman's an Amaleki. Haman came from Agag, became Amalek, who was spared by Shmuel. Haman's an Amaleki. So the original sin of Adam and Chava, the Nachash and Gan Eden, Haman, Amalek, they're all one big club, basically. You know, they're all associated with one another. They're all that same force in the world. And what is this force? I mean, it's a funny thing, because, I mean, Nachash was wicked, and Haman's wicked, and Amalek is wicked, but where do you see them all coming together? So Haman's easier, because Haman actually is a descendant of Amalek. But to associate that back to Gan Eden is an interesting thing. But Chazal referred to Amalek as a snake. You find that Amalek's compared to Hai Chivya, to the snake which ambushes you on the road. And we find a few different references to the idea of Amalek being a snake. So what's the idea of Amalek? And this is really a broader idea. But Purim is about destroying Amalek. Haman's from Amalek, and we read Parshas Zachar prior to Purim, because Purim is the day we're supposed to think about destruction of Amalek. So Amalek is the power in this world, which was created basically to cloud our emunah. We talked about the idea of being confused, of itzadas. Whose role is it to make us confused? So Amalek is not just a person, not just a nation. Amalek was a person. There was a grandson of Esau named Amalek. And Amalek had children. They made a nation out of it. But really, that's only one part of it. Amalek is actually a concept. Amalek is a spiritual force in the world. And the spiritual force of Amalek is the force that's put in this world to give us a challenge, to confuse us, to cloud our emunah, to keep us from bringing Hashem into our lives, to keep us confused, and to prevent that clarity from happening in this world. That's really what Amalek is. Rav Volta, he talks about it in the sense of a mushroom. He says Amalek is the germ that infects us, talking about everyone getting sick. The germ that infects us to make us not fear Hashem is called Amalek. That germ spreads. And the ability in our lives that we can ignore Hashem, the ability that we can go against Hashem, the ability that we can live life with doubts and questions, that's all a result of the germ called Amalek. That's what this germ is. Very famously, in Amalek is Gematria 240, which equals Suffolk, doubt, because Amalek gives us doubts. The fact that we have doubts about Amunah, doubts about life, doubts about Hashem, that's based on this force called Amalek. Amalek, less famously, is the Gematria of El Acher, other gods. Because Amalek makes us think at times there's other forces in the world that have power. Ultimately, Hashem is the only power in life. But Amalek gives us the ability to think there is El Acher, there are other gods out there, and other gods don't mean idols necessarily, it can mean other things of importance other than Hashem. There's money, and there's power, and there's fame also are other gods. And Amalek is the Gematria, again, 240 is El Acher. Amalek is also the Gematria of Mar, bitter. Because Amalek injects into life bitterness. And they're here with a sinister intent to get us to separate from Hashem and live life, you know, not with the truth, not with emes, not with certainty. And that's why when Amalek comes to the Torah to attack us, it follows the pasuk, Hayesh Hashem b'kirvenu ayin. The Klal Yisrael asks, Hashem with us or not? You know, they had a doubt in Amunah. And immediately the Torah says, if you have Amalek comes in. So the idea of doubting Amunah and Amalek are one big idea, because Amalek is that force, that germ in the world that gives us doubts. It's a force that really our current lives that we have grapple with Amalek all the time. So right now in 2017, we don't know who actually is from the nation of Amalek. Now, we don't know. Sancheirov came in, Gemara tells us, and mixed up all the nations. We don't know who's who. So there's nobody in the world right now we would kill as a member of Amalek. But that force is still there. The fact that we live life and that we have doubts and we have questions and we put our trust into other forces other than Hashem, that's all a result of Amalek. That's all a result of this force. It's still in the world. It's still alive and it's still thriving. Amalek is here right now, and Amalek, that force is with us to this very day. Until Mashiach comes, Amalek's force is with us. That's how it works. Adam now, after his chait, he's been infected by the force called Amalek. Not the person wasn't even born yet, but the force. And now Adam thinks he can hide from Hashem and deny reality. Adam now can see events happening and think that they're external to Hashem. The concept of Tov V'ra also means that we see things in life and we think that they're bad, meaning that Hashem is not guiding them. Because if Hashem is guiding it, it's not bad. We have the impression sometimes that things happen and we don't see Hashem's hand in it. And we get very confused by it and think, this is a bad thing. How could this be? Where is Hashem? We ask the question, but ultimately Hashem is there, but we don't see it because, you know, this force has infected us. One of the results of the chait was, you have to eat by the sweat of your brow. So that means, on one level, that we think that when we work, our food is provided by us. We work and we make food now. It used to be, it's very clear, Hashem gave the food. We spoke about the trees a few weeks ago. The trees were there, they grew, and we took the fruits. That was clearly from Hashem. But now when we have to work so hard for our food, we miss Hashem and think that it's the result of our own personal talents and work, we get our food. And the whole concept of not seeing Hashem in life, and seeing the evil in the Bria everywhere, and having doubts and sveikos, all these things, we think the world's like spiraling away from Hashem. The world is like out of Hashem's control in some way, in our minds at least. And that's all a result of this. All a result of Amalek, it's Das Tovara, it's all there. So most history unfolds at this point. After Adam and Chava sin, so at that point the world has been infected by the sin. It's in the person. When you eat something, it's inside of you. You are what you eat. It's true on many levels. And the Tzahara is within us, the doubts are within us, and from here on out, you know, we're stuck with it. And that's the world. So the first era is finished when they do the chait. So now that leads to the longest era of history that we at least we're aware of right now, which is where we are today. That we have to live life with this struggle, with these doubts, with Amalek. However, it's interesting because this was said by Bilam. Bilam tells us a very important thing. Bilam, who was a non-Jew but he was a Navi, he told us Rishis goyim Amalek v'achrisu adi oved. He told us that Amalek was the first of the nations. But his destiny is destruction. Meaning that the world of Achariso Adi Oved, the future world, has no place for Amalek. Every other nation has a place in the future world. When Hashiach comes, all the nations will be here. You'll have the French, you'll have the Spanish, you'll have the Americans, you'll have the Canadians, you'll have the Japanese, you know, everyone's going to be around still. Because everybody can find their place in the future world. Because every single person created by Hashem has a purpose they can fulfill. And the Goyim are created for a reason as well, and they have a purpose, and every single nation will have its place, Lasid Lavo. Except Amalek. Amalek has no place, Lasid Lavo. Amalek is Achrisu Adi Oved, because in a world of perfection, they have no place. Because they're the ones who create the lack of perfection. They're the ones who create the doubts in the world. They're the ones who create evil in the world. So in a future world, their only hope is to be destroyed. They have no other place. They don't fit anywhere. By definition, Amalek holds the world back from its tikkun, from its perfection. And if they're here, the world cannot be perfected. Once they are gone, the world's perfected. But a perfect world can't have Amalek inside of it. So Amalek is, in the future, in the machar, if you will, they're going to be destroyed, and they're going to be gone. And every other nation will have their place besides Amalek. So whoever the Amalek is, this force and this nation, both, you know, the people who are genetically Amalek and the force of Amalek spiritually will be destroyed. And that's how the world becomes a very different place. So it's like we finally found the cure for this germ. The germ of Amalek, we can cure it. That's the perfection of the world. But Amalek's role is in the world as we have it right now, it's in the present. Amalek's role is in Olam Hazeh in the present time. Not in the future, not in the past, but in the present era. Because we have three eras. We have the first era, second era, and the third era. So Amalek's role is going to be in this second era. During this long part of history, post the chait, before Mashiach, the life we live right now, Amalek has their power, they're here, and they're doing their job. It's very interesting because Amalek, essentially, they come from Esav. Esav was the grandfather of Amalek, and much of Amalek's, you know, wickedness is found in Esav. So if you understand a little bit about Esav, you know, Esav is the one who claimed, Hinei Anochi Olam Lamus, he says, I'm going to die anyways. Actually, I have it here in source number 12. Yeah, here, if you look at source 12. Esav says, Vimar Esav, Hinei Anochi Olam Lamus. Esav says, I'm going to die anyways. V'lama Zili Bechora, what do I need the Bechora for? I don't need to be the firstborn. I need that, I'm going to die. The firstborn is a spiritual level, and I don't need these spiritual things. So, what is Esav doing right there? If you look at source 13, the first line there is Targum Yonasan. This is one of the Aramaic translations of the Torah. Targum Yonasan says, Amar Esav, Ha'ana Azio Lemimas. Esav says, I'm going to die anyways. Beles Ana Chaye Tu Ba'olam Acharon. That I'm not going to live in another world. He denies Olam Haba. V'lama Dzan Li Bechirusa, Chuka De Ba'alma Da Amar. So why do I need to have the Bechora and the portion of the world that you're talking about? May Esav denies a future world. He says, I know I'm going to enjoy my life right now. Eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's what Esav says. I don't have any place in a future world. I don't need this Bechorah. Forget about it. That's what Esav tells Yaakov Avinu. So Esav's Koifer and Olam Haba. He denies Olam Haba. He denies a future world. Esav lives for this world. He lives for the present. He lives for enjoying himself in this life. But he has no shaychas, no connection to anything beyond. You know, Esav is for the now, and Yaakov lives for the future. Right? Esav, his name itself, Esav means he is done. You know, he comes out, he is fully grown. There's no future for Esav. He is as he is. You know, he's kind of locked in as Esav. Yaakov's name, as Yitzchak, is future tense. You know, the Yod Neshon HaKodesh means the future. Because Yaakov lives for the future, Esav lives for this world. So that's Amalek's grandfather, Esav. And it comes out on Amalek. It really does. And Rav Hutner points out, if you look back at source number 12, Vayomer Yaakov, Hishava li kayom, Vayishava lo. Vayimka Esav es becharos el Yaakov. So he says, Hishava li kayom. Now swear to me as today. We can mafarshim struggle with what's this concept kayom. But Rav Hutner says that when you're talking to Esav, you talk his language. You know, Esav only recognizes today. He doesn't recognize anything about the future, but today is Esav's world. Not the machar, but the hayom. That's what Esav's all about. So that's Amalek's grandfather. And then Amalek comes in. We live in a time of Amalek, and Amalek comes to attack Klal Yisrael. She here somewhere. Let's see. Yeah, this is back on source number 7. So Klal Yisrael has left Mitzrayim. They are on their way to Har Sinai. This is what we're talking about now, the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, Sfirsa Omer. And if you look in the Chumash, we know that in Oz Yashar we say that all the nations were terrified of Klal Yisrael at this point. Shema Am Yergozim. All the nations heard about Mitzrayim, Yergozim, they trembled. The people who lived in Plishtim, they were snatched by terror. Everyone who lived in Canaan, they melted out of fear. Everyone was terrified of Klal Yisrael. We were invincible. Nobody could touch us. We were on the top of the world. And who comes to attack us? Amalek. Because they can't stand that. Now, they can't stand that there's a nation that's going to be able to profess and express HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Achdus and the Hashgach of Hashem and the Kedusha of Hashem. They can't deal with it. Someone comes to attack, and Chazal tell us in Mashal, they say that it's like there's a boiling hot bathtub, and nobody can go in because it's so hot. But one person jumps in, he gets burned, but now it's cooled off for everyone else. That's the Mashal Chazal give. And that's Amalek. Nobody would touch us. We were on fire. We were scary. Amalek comes to attack, and they lose. But, you know, they put up a battle. So now the nation says, okay, we're not invincible. You know, we're also vulnerable. And the Amalek didn't get struck by lightning, and they didn't get swallowed up by frogs. They didn't get any varot on their head. You know, Klal Yisrael could also be attacked like another nation. That's what Amalek did. They lost the battle, but they cooled off the bathtub. So after that battle, Hashem, Kevyochol, he swears. And if you look at source number 7, Vayomer, Hashem said, Ki yod al kes ka, the hand is on the throne of Hashem. Nochamal Hashem ba'Amalek midor dor. There's a war of Hashem against Amalek for all generations. So this is where the source of the concept of destroying Amalek is based on this battle. Because Amalek came in to attack us before Matan Torah, when nobody else would dare to attack us. But the way it's expressed in the Torah is very interesting. Besides the fact that Hashem is taking a Shavuah, that's an interesting discussion in its own right, the language used is Yad al Kes Ka, a hand on the throne of Hashem. But the word Kes is missing an Aleph, it's just a Kiseh, and it says Kes. And the name of Hashem should be Yud Kei Vav Kei, it's just Yud and Hey, just Ka. It doesn't say Yud Kei Vav Kei, it says just Yad Al Kes Ka. There's a letter lacking in the word Kiseh, and two letters lacking in Hashem's name. So Rashi tells us, if you look at the next source here, number 8, Rashi says, Yomer Moshe Yad Al Kes Ka, Gado Shel Kosh Baruch Hu Hurma Lishava Bekiso, Hashem's hand is lifted to swear by his throne, Lioslo Melchama the Eva Bamalek, he's going to have a war against Amalek Olamis for all generations. Umahu Kase, why does it say Kase Vulnam or Kisina Kise? Vav Hashem Nechlach Lechetzin, also the name of Hashem is divided in half, we're missing half of Hashem's name. Nishbakash Baruchush in Shmo Shalem and Kiso Shalom, Hashem swears and says that my name is not complete and my throne is not complete Ad she yimche shmo shel Moloch kulo, until Moloch is totally destroyed. Because yimche shmo, when Moloch is destroyed, yeah, Hashem shalom kisa shalom. Hashem's name will be complete, and his throne will be complete. So I'll stop there in the Rashi. But there's a concept we see very clearly. When a Moloch's in the world, Hashem's name and Hashem's throne are incomplete. So what does that mean? Hashem is never incomplete. But it means our perception. It means that we don't perceive Hashem's throne fully. Hashem's throne means the way Hashem runs the world, like a king, sitting his throne running the country. We don't perceive that. It's limited. Hashem's name, your name is how I relate to you. You use a name to relate to somebody else, and we can't relate to Hashem fully. And whose fault is that? So a Moloch is that force that prevents us from relating in that way. So a Moloch comes to attack, and we find that we're living in a world, when a Moloch's around, that things are incomplete, that Hashem's hashkacha is not so clear, our ability to perceive Hashem is not so clear, we have a distance from Hashem. And history and the world don't quite fit, we don't quite see how Hashem is running it all. That's what a Moloch does to us. So that's all part of the second era of history. But there's a machar, there's a future. The machar is tomorrow, it's the future. And if you look at source 14, right, source 14 here, it's a Yalkut Shimoni, it's a Medrash, and it says, this is actually a Megillus Esther, Machar Esek Edvar HaMelech. So I think that's Esther speaking. She says, tomorrow I will do as the Melech says. Ma Rasul Mar Machar, why did she say Machar? Because we find that Amalek's descendants, they always fall on the Machar, on the tomorrow. When Moshe Rabbeinu fights Amalek, so if you look at the Parshas B'Shalach, Moshe Rabbeinu says, tomorrow I'll be standing on the hill. And that's what fight the battle. Look at the next source, 15. This is when David fights Amalek. It says, V'yakim David Neshef out of Erev L'macharasam. David struck Amalek from the Neshef, from the evening, by the Erev, until the following evening, L'macharasam, on the next day. And if you look at the next source, 16, another, it's Rashi and Shmuel, the same concept. L'mudim heim Amalekim l'kos b'yomachar. Amalek is always destined to be destroyed on the Machar. Kol Shenemar, as it says, Machar Ninoch, like the same source, from Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's why David also struck them down, L'macharasam, on the Machar. So the time to fight Amalek and destroy Amalek is in the tomorrow. In the today, Amalek is here. The today, we're post the sin of Adam and Chava. Amalek is here and Amalek is doing their job. But when do you fight Amalek? When does Amalek actually, when are they destroyed? Only in the Machar, only in the tomorrow. The Baal Turim says, when it says in the Pasuk, Mecham L'Shem B'Amalek Midor Dor, that we fight against Amalek for every generation, the Baal Turim says, the Musa Mashiach. The time of Mashiach is when the war ends. That's when they get destroyed. But we find when Moshe fought Amalek, it was Machar, the next day. We find when David fought Amalek, it was the Macharasam, the next day. We find when Esther was dealing with Haman, it was Machar. Now we understand, Esther requested, come back tomorrow for another party. Now why would she do that? So on a deep level, it's because Esther understood that Amalek only dies in the tomorrow, not in the today. So I can't fight Haman today, I have to make a tomorrow to fight Haman. Obviously that's more of a metaphor. But Esther understood that Amalek has to fall in the Machar. And that's why she requested, I would like to, excuse me, I want to have another day to fight Amalek. We should fight them again tomorrow. There's a stress on tomorrow in the Megillah because Amalek's downfall is always in the tomorrow, never in the today. That's how Amalek is. The only time you find, that I know at least, you find fighting Amalek not in the tomorrow is the failed fight against Amalek. When Shaul himself fought Amalek, Shaul was told by Shmuel, this is your chance, you're the first king of Israel, you have the job of destroying Amalek. So Shaul is sent out to destroy Amalek, and Shaul comes back, and he failed. He left alive the king and some animals. And Hashem said, I'm disgusted at Shaul. What he did was a disgusting thing. I regret choosing him as king. He didn't follow my instructions. They said, kill every single person, every single animal. He left them alive. If you look in the Navi, that battle was not in the Machar. You know, it's interesting. That battle, it doesn't say anything about Machar in that battle. Every single other battle against Amalek, the successful ones, were done in the tomorrow. Because it's symbolic of the fact that Amalek's place in this world is only in the present. But tomorrow is when they get destroyed. That's the symbolism of it. So what this means on a larger level is that the world has a machar. The world has a future. The future where Amalek is gone. Where the Shem is Shalem, where Hashem's name is complete. Where the Kisei is Shalem, Hashem's throne is complete. The Gemara says, if you look at here, source number 9. This is the Gemara Maseches Pesachim. This is a pasuk we say all the time in Aleinu. It says that Hashem, on that day, in the future, Hashem will be king over the land. On that day, His name will be one. Hashem will be one, His name will be one. So the Gemara asks, Atu Idna Lav Echadu? What does it mean that Hashem will be one on that day? Is Hashem not one right now? Hashem is always one. Of course Hashem is one. So what does it mean Hashem will be one on that day? Amr Yacha Bar Chanina Lolo Kolom Hazeh Olam Haba. So Baruch Bar Chanina says, the Olam Hazeh is not like Olam Haba. There's two different existences in this world. Olam Hazeh Al Besuros Tovos Omer Baruch HaTov Meitiv. In this world, in the present, as we live right now, if something good happens to us, there's a bracha to make. The bracha is Baruch HaTov V'Meitiv. Blessed is Hashem who is good and does good. Abasuros Ros, on evil tidings. If Chas V'Shalom, somebody hears very bad news, there's a bracha to make on that as well. We say, Baruch Dayana Emes. That's this world. Because why? There's a distinction between what we call good, we call bad. Right now, we can say the words that we know Hashem does everything for the good. That we know. But we don't always feel it that way. When Chas V'Shalom, a tragedy happens, it's very hard for us to say on that, this is good. At least meaning it. HaTov V'Meitiv really should apply to everything. Hashem's always good. Hashem doesn't do anything bad. Everything Hashem does is for the good. But we don't perceive it that way. We feel that things are tragic sometimes. We feel things are bad sometimes. And Chazal recognized this, and they gave us two brachos. So when things are good in our perception, we say, Baruch HaTov V'Meitiv. Blessed is Hashem who is good and does good. When things in our perception are not so good, so we still praise Hashem for it. The bracha we make is Dayana Emes. We say, Hashem, you're praised because you are the true judge. I don't get it. I don't know why this is good. I don't know what you're doing, but I trust Hashem. He's the true judge, and I make the bracha. But that's because it's a concession. We're conceding that we don't understand everything. Hashem knows and we don't. So we're conceding to Hashem. But we can't say the word is bracha tov meitiv on that because we think it's bad. It's not. You know, the scheme of things, everything is good. Everything Hashem does is for the good. But we don't see that. In Olam Haba, though, the Gemara says in Olam Haba, Kulo Tov Meitiv. The only thing you'll say is Tov Meitiv. Which could mean, on one level, that even the things that we see right now seem to be very, very tragic. In Olam Haba, looking back, we'll say these things were incredible. These were so good. There's nothing bad at all. Everything Hashem does is for the good. And to me, that is a symbol of Megillas Esther. If you were standing there in Shushan, and Haman came out and made the decree to kill every single Jew in the entire Persian Empire, which is basically the whole world at the time, so we would think, this is terrible, this is awful, this is Dina Emes, that's what we would say. We would say, I don't know what's happening here, this looks terrible, this looks like the world is finished, but Hashem knows what's happened, Hashem knows what He's doing, Dina Emes. You finish the Megillah, and you look back, and you say, wow, the best thing that happened to us was Haman decreeing to destroy us. That was amazing. Because when Haman decreed to destroy us, what happened? Well, we all did tshuva, and that we all recommitted ourselves to the Torah, and we created a brand new Yom Tov, which is a very special and exciting, happy day. And this actually led back to the building of the second Beis Hamikdash. So, if Haman didn't come out to decree our death, then we would have been stuck in Persia. I mean, you know, we don't know what would happen after that. Only because Haman came out and decreed against us, it became one of the greatest events, the happiest events in all Jewish history. Haman to us was amazing. He was great. Haman was doing something that was very good for us. But we only figured that out afterwards. So the idea, when a malach is in the world, you see things that are bad, you can't see the good in them. You can't see it. Like we're saying, Hashem is not echa. I mean, we don't see how Hashem is echa. We don't see that Hashem is always doing good. Only l'asid lavo, in the future, at that point, it's all automated. We can look back, a malach is gone out of the world. We look back and we say, wow, now we see how everything was really for the good. You know, I mean, it's hard to say these words, but this idea would mean that Masalavo, we'll look back at the Holocaust and we'll say, that was great. That was amazing. We can't say that right now. The words sound ridiculous. But it's the same thing. Haman, we look back at Haman was amazing. Haman was the best friend. You know, Haman for us did amazing things. But at the time in Shushan, the Jews couldn't have said it either. Only when they finish the story, they can look back and they can say that. So to us, so many things in life, we don't see how they're good. To us, they look terrible. But we know Hashem always does everything, does for the good. So we look back later on, we'll look back, you know, in retrospect, and we'll say, now I understand why it was so great. Now I understand that every single event in my life was just what I needed. It was perfect. But that's what the Gemara is telling us. And that's the idea, I think, in Kisei Sholem and Shemoshim. Hashem is not complete, and Hashem's throne is not complete, because we don't see everything fully. We don't see the full picture. We don't understand why is this considered a good hashkacha of Hashem? Why is this something which is good for me and for the world? I just don't get it. I don't understand it. But when Amalek is destroyed, the clarity comes in. The suffix is gone. The el-akhir is gone. All the bitterness is gone. And you can look back and you can see that these things which we thought were terrible were really very, very good. And the Purim story ends this way. The Purim story ends in a way that really resembles Amalek out of the world. During the Purim story, we killed out Amalek to the best of our ability. I mean, some still lived on, but this, to us, Purim is the celebrating the greatest destruction of Amalek we could ever do until times of Mashiach. So Haman is destroyed, his sons are destroyed, all of our enemies are destroyed in Persia. And the story ends in an amazing way. The Purim story ends that every single person in the Persian Empire respects Mordechai and respects Klal Yisrael. It says, many, many Goyim, they wanted to become Jewish because they had such a reverence for Mordechai and for Klal Yisrael. There's this achdus, which is unbelievable. You know, everybody has gotten together. Esther says, Knos Kol Yehudim, gather all the Jews together. They should fast for me, they should daven, but there was a unity which was created. The idea of Shalch Manas, Tanslav Yonim, they create a unity in Klal Yisrael. It's one of the days of the year that everyone feels like so close to one another in Purim. The story ended with tshuva. Every single Jew did tshuva. Everybody came back. The Chazal tell us kimu v'kiblu that we recommit ourselves to Torah once again. In our Sinai, we accept the Torah out of fear, and our Purim, we accept it out of love. So there was another level of Kabbalah Torah which went even beyond Shavuos after the end of the Purim story. And then ultimately, you don't see it in the Megillah, but ultimately it was Achashverosh's son who allowed us to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash and brought us back to Eretz Yisrael. So the Purim story really leads us into the building of Bayis Sheni and our return to Eretz Yisrael. That's pretty amazing. So if you have a picture in your head, what's Yimus Mashiach going to be like? And the Rambam says that, you know, don't expect any miracles. That's not the point. The point is a very, very powerful king who is a tzaddik, who, because he is so righteous and so special, such an inspirational leader, he'll bring back Jews to Yiddishkeit, he'll bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, and all the nations of the world will look with him with respect and look to Klal Yisrael with respect. So we'll be brought back, we'll have unity, we'll be brought back together with the tshuva, and the nations will respect us. I mean, that's really the picture of Yimus HaMashiach. That's what it is. And there'll be a certain clarity of Hashem in this world that every single person will recognize the Kosh Baruch. Well, that'll all be there. So this is all a result of the Nes of Purim, and this is really just a picture of what's going to be like in the times of Mashiach. So to get to that, that's the Machar. No, where is the world headed? Where's the finish line? So the finish line is a world like we're describing, a world of unity, a world of love, a world of tshuva, a world of recognition of Hashem, a world of respect for Klal Yisrael, respect for Torah. That's what it's headed towards. That's the finish line. That's the goal. So what's getting us there? So Purim tells us that to get to Machar, to get to that point, the Malk has to be destroyed. This only happens in the Machar, in the future. It doesn't happen right now. So we want to get to the stage three, this third stage of the Bria. We want to get to that point. So Purim doesn't mark the day of the Nes. And this goes back to our first question. Purim marks, it's on the Machar. Purim is the next day. Right, the day we celebrate Purim, as we said back in the first source we read today, in source number 2, we celebrate Purim on Yom Arba Asar, Asher Nadei Nochu Behem, the day we rested. Because Purim is not the day we mark the miracle of destroying our enemies. Purim is the day where we live out the future. Purim is the day where we're living out the Yimus HaMashiach. So the day you fight the battle is not Yimus HaMashiach. It's the next day, when all the enemies are gone, and now Klal Yisrael can live with Hashem in harmony, with the respect of all the goyim, and you know, with the ability to serve Hashem as we wish, that's the day of Purim. That's the day that we're supposed to be marking, because that's the day where we're tasting Yimus HaMashiach. It's not the day of the battle; it's the next day. It's the day that we got to rest in the Menucha. We describe Olam Haba, which is a little different than Yimus HaMashiach. We describe it as Yom Shkul Shabbos Menucha. It's the time where we have total rest. But that's the Purim is the day where we're supposed to be at rest. Meaning we're celebrating, we're not celebrating, we're living. We're living a day of Yimus HaMashiach. That's the Purim I'm supposed to tell you all about. So we don't celebrate the victory, but rather we have a day where we get to taste Mashiach. That's the day we get to have. It's like, you know, it's the happily ever after of the story. That's what it is. We're living in the happily ever after. You know, you never know what happens in the happily ever after of the story. It just says the happily ever after. But that's where we are. Purim is that we are in the happily ever after. That's what Purim is. Purim is not... The Chazal tells something very interesting. This is number source number 6. It's hard to know how literally to take this, but certainly the concept is there. The Medrash says, Komo Adam Yehu Batalim. Lasa Lavo, all the holidays will be batal. They'll all be cancelled. Purim, Lo Yinafel Olam. But Purim is never batal. Purim will always exist. Shinemar, Vepurim Ha'elu Le'avru Tuch Yehudim, V'zichem L'Yitzuf Mizarim. It says that Purim shall not pass from amongst the Jews, and their memory should never cease from their children. So Purim is something which is eternal. So what's the idea that Purim is eternal? Because Purim is the existence of the eternity. Purim is the existence of the future. So you're not going to cancel Purim because the future is Purim. Purim is the future, and the future is Purim. It's all one thing. It all goes together. So that's what Purim is. Again, we're living in the happily ever after. We're living in that world of the third phase of the creation where a Malik is gone, and we live in a time of total happiness. And we get to live this on Purim. Purim is a day we get to live it. Purim is a day of pure simcha. It's a day where, in our minds, nothing should matter besides connecting to other Jews, doing our mitzvos, celebrating, Avas Yisrael, Torah. It's a day where we're supposed to be oblivious to everything else besides serving Hashem and the simcha of the day. We shouldn't have any inhibitions on Purim from celebrating. We should just celebrate with pure simcha and, you know, pure celebration. One of the connections I have in my mind between Yom Kippur and Purim, as we said, that Rizal connects them, is that both days are days we should be oblivious to anything else besides Hashem. On Yom Kippur, we're oblivious to everything else because we have such a day of such awe, and such a holy, and such a day of the fear of Hashem. But on Purim, the simcha of the day makes oblivious to everything else. On Purim, I don't want to deal with anything else. It's just I want to celebrate Purim. It's time a day of full simcha, 100% simcha. That's what Purim is all about. It's because when you're living in a world without a malik, living in this world of joy with no doubts and with nothing else in your mind, no el acher, so all you want to do is celebrate with Hashem. That's what you want to do. We say at the end of the Megillah, the Jews had light, and they had happiness, and they had celebration, and they had yakar, they had like respect. So that was the ultimate result of the whole story. It was just total light of Hashem, clarity. Chazal tell us, Ora first the Torah, that they were able to see the light of Torah, the Simcha of Yantif, and they were able to really, really celebrate and have that self-respect and have respect from others for who they are, for being Klal Yisrael. So to me, this is an idea that hits so many points about Purim, because every single part of Purim is about the Simcha, it's about the love of every single Jew, and it's about the Simcha being a Jew. And that's what Purim is, this taste of a world, which is this totally different existence. And it's one day in the calendar we get to try to drive everything else out of our minds. And that's really, our avoda is that we want to get everything else out of our minds and just tap into Simcha of the day. If we can do that, the day kind of carries us. You know, Purim's always a crazy day. You know, Purim between Megillah and Shalch Manis and Suda and everything else, it's one day and it's just, boom, you know, it all comes at us. I remember I was in Eretz Yisrael once, and in Yerushalayim they had a 3-day Purim. And when Purim's on Shabbos, it's a Purim Shulash, it's divided over 3 days. And to me, it lost some of its excitement, because it's like, every day was kind of diluted. Now, part of Purim really is that feeling, that there's so much to do today, I'm so excited, I have so much on my mind, I can't wait to do it. When you do a little Purim on Friday, and a little on Shabbos, a little on Sunday, it wasn't quite the same for me. You know, I didn't have that same boost of adrenaline. Purim's like that. So we have to be able to, the day itself lends to kind of zeroing in on Purim and driving everything else out of our minds. But if we can do that, we can really taste a day which is from a different world, from a different existence, a day of the future, a day of total simcha. So when you talk about the month of Adar as the last month of the year, it's the month, like we said, it's not just the day, it's the month. It's the Chodesh Shernepach Lehem, it's the month, the Megillah says, that was flipped from Yogun to Simcha and Evil to Yom Tov. Because Purim is the month where Adar is the month. We're supposed to be able to taste this, taste the goal of history, because the last month in the calendar, therefore, represents the final steps of history. That's what Adar represents. And, you know, the history leads to the point that the Hester Panim, all the concealment of Hashem, which we've gone through all these years, will bring us to its purpose, and we can look back and see how everything that happened really tied into bringing us to that purpose. You know, history itself has happily ever after. It has its goal. It has its tachlis. It's all there. It's a matter of us trying to understand it. And again, the Megillah is that little model of it. The Megillah shows you one part of history of all the events that look terrible, really, really great, and led to a tremendous, tremendous Neis Segula for Klal Yisrael. And all of history is like that. Everything in history will lead that to that direction as well. And really, all of history is one big Megillah Esther. That's what it is. And I don't know if there's going to be Megillah written when Mashiach comes, but you can imagine a Megillah Esther when Mashiach comes. And it'll go through everything that happened, Chorban, and destruction, and Golus, and Inquisition, and the Holocaust, and all these things. And at the end, you're going to figure out why all that stuff was really good and tied into the Nis. We're going to figure it out. We don't know right now, because we're in the middle of the story right now. And right now, we're sitting in Shushan, and we don't know what's going to happen. But once it all happens, you look back and you say, wow, I have clarity now, everything is so clear. Because once a Amalek is gone, then your life is, you have a whole different look at the world. And everything is different. So Purim, we have the day, it's a day we can achieve some level of clarity and a tremendous level of simcha in the fact that we're tasting something out of a different world.